purposes of the court. May it please the court, my name is Ronald Robinson. I am the appellant. And if I could, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
There are three basic topics that are covered in the assignments of error, and that is the subpoena, Rule 1.4A, and the terms.
Well, there's a big issue as well, and that's the motion to dismiss, so don't fail to address that. Go ahead.
I'll attempt to address that. I did not realize I was going to have to address that today.
Pardon?
I did not realize I had to address that today, Your Honor.
It may be the biggest issue before you today. Go ahead.
To understand this properly, it's actually easiest to start at the end of this case, not the beginning. If you start at the beginning, you're going to fill your mind with all kinds of errors that were introduced by not only the client but the bar. And by the time you get to the end, the law of primacy will have taken over and you will have poisoned your mind with the bad facts instead of starting at the end and going backwards. And if you start at the end, lawyers aren't liked by a lot of people in society, and then divorce lawyers are probably the least liked. So that's my profession. If you start at the end, you'll see that the client became very unhappy at the four-way, after the four-way meeting, settlement conference. It was the first time that I had met her. We represented her for almost 2 years without having met her. It was all phone calls and emails and letters. After the four-way, she did not like my advice. She asked me, and it's reflected in the appendix, she asked me to withhold information from her husband, income information, an income and expense sheet for any of you that have practiced divorce law. It's pretty routine. And that's where the genesis of the problem started. Not with bills, not with communication, not with contracts, not with any of the stuff that led up to it. It started there. Because if you look at the sum total of the communications from the beginning until then, things were fine. It progressed as a normal out-of-court divorce case where people did not want to spend money going into court. They couldn't settle. They went back and forth. There's one email where I'm supposedly the greatest attorney in the world. Take that with a grain of salt. You can't even look at isolated emails over a period of 2 years that may evidence that the client is confused. Clients are often confused. Just because someone expresses in an email that, hey, I don't know about something, doesn't mean that they weren't told about it or we weren't communicated about it. So what the bar would have you believe and what it had would have the committee believe was that this was all about the finances. But again, if you look at the sum total of the communication, the lack of understanding, as in a typical divorce case, covers all areas, not just finances or how much more is it going to cost. I don't understand the spousal support issue. It doesn't matter that you've explained it 5 or 10 times. That's normal. So I would submit that you, to have a proper understanding of it, to start at the end of the reputation with a client that was not happy and that wanted to move on to another attorney, I guess that would do her for bidding, and then that's when the problem started. The other thing that I think Your Honor needs to understand is that in presenting the case, the bar ignores large swaths of evidence. It's almost as if I wasn't in the room. And they kind of have two principles. One of the principles is, I've started to change the way I do things with clients because of this, and I don't like it. It's the cover your rear end principle of having to have everything in writing. So if you read their arguments and the things that they cite, essentially it's, if it's not an email, you're toast. Forget it. Doesn't matter that it took place in a phone call. Doesn't matter that there were phone calls in the list of on the invoice. Doesn't matter that the client acknowledged that they had phone calls. They want something in writing. And then the other one is that no matter what question or confusion or request that the client has that's in any way related to finances, the bar essentially takes the position that if it's not an invoice that you provided, then you didn't provide them with any reasonable information as required. So,
well, let me ask you this: was the $10,000 for in-court legal services?
No, sir.
It was not.
No, sir. That was, again, from reading from the beginning, that's one of the problems that cropped up was this whole thing about the contracts. The contracts that I used actually came out of a CLE when I first started practicing law, and they emphasized that, you know, especially for divorce lawyers, it's real important to have a dividing line between when you're just doing out-of-court stuff and when you're going to do in-court and out-of-court stuff for reasons of retroactivity, clients claiming, hey, you said you were going to file my case 6 months ago, to have a nice bright line of when you're being hired and you're on the hook for that type of for those types of services. So if you get through the entire record, you get to the point where you realize at that point the contract, all the stuff about the contract, all that dropped out. The stuff about I didn't provide a draft settlement agreement for 20 months, all of a sudden, oh, well, actually, that's not true. She claimed that she turned $10,000 in cash over to a receptionist. That wasn't true. But you have to wade through a lot of that, and I'm sorry that you had to do that. But it really does come down to the simple issues of the subpoena, the Rule 1.4A meaning, and the terms. Terms are not unusual, but terms that are arbitrary and vague are. 1.4A, I don't know many attorneys, I don't know any attorneys actually that think that 1.4A applies to billing and invoicing. We have a rule that covers fees, and that's 1.5, I believe. And as for the subpoena, Your Honors have a lot of experience under your belt. If those subpoenas are unreasonable, then we've lost the ability for the attorney to defend himself. Those were the only witnesses that were pertinent. And I know the bar made questions about a proffer. Again, if you read the entire record, it's in there. It's in the appendix. I discussed the husband, and I also discussed the opposing counsel who was at the four-way where we discussed attorney's fees and where we were on attorney's fees in detail. So it would have been nice to have him there. And I know that she was sharing this information, and I testified to that, but she was sharing this information with her husband. So on my behalf, it would have been nice if I could defend myself properly by having the only two witnesses that she would have had any discussions with about fees there to say yes and explain what his understanding was, because she knew about the fees and what the status was. Same thing with the attorney who could have testified what went on at the four-way and how deep we got into where we were on attorney's fees and what had happened.
All right, you wanted to save some time. Is this the point where you'd like to do that?
Yes,
you have 6 minutes and 41 seconds.
Thank you, Chief.
May it please the Court, my name is Ryan Doherty. I'm with the Office of the Attorney General, and I'm here on behalf of the Virginia State Bar today. Thank you for the opportunity to address the motion to dismiss. I do think that is an important part of this case. There are mandatory requirements in Rule 527. They use the word shall. The statement of facts has to have references to the appendix. In this case, there weren't, not one. In the assignments of error, you need to relate them to the arguments. That also did not happen in this case. Legal authority, that is also missing in this case. You don't find that anywhere beyond the standard of review in appellant's brief. There's nothing to support his legal argument or his legal conclusions. And that is a failure to adequately brief and should be considered a waiver by this court. Further, he does restate the arguments that he made below in a summary fashion. That is likewise not adequate and should serve as a waiver in this court. Additionally, he relies with respect to the subpoenas specifically, evidence that is not part of the record. Evidence that is not part of the record is not considered in an appeal. In this case, there was nothing in the record to demonstrate to this court that this issue should be considered on appeal, and that issue being the subpoena and summons issue. And having failed all those, the appellant shouldn't be afforded the opportunity to seek relief from this court. There are specific rules that you're required to follow. They were not followed in this case, and the court should not address the brief because of those deficiencies. With that said, I can move on to the main argument if you would like. Without waiving the motion to dismiss that I've just discussed, the appellant takes issue with the public reprimand with terms. As I said, without citation to authority or law, it appears that he has adopted the same bucket that we have. We included them as three things. One, the summons and subpoena issue, assignment of error one. The second would be a violation of Rule 1.4a. That was assignments of error 2 through 6 and 8. And the third would be the terms, his specific disagreement with the terms that were imposed, and that was assignment of error 8. The bar submits that all of the findings and ultimate order were justified by a reasonable view of the evidence, and they're not contrary to the law. There's nothing in appellant's brief that would suggest otherwise. And if we look at the specific issues, number one, the summons and subpoena, they are allowed. Either party can request them, and they're granted unless they're unreasonable. Either party may move to quash, and the committee can rule on those motions to quash. All of those things happened in this case. The appellant asked for subpoenas and summons. The bar issued its objections and its motion to quash. That was heard. It was granted. The record evidence before this court consists of that, the objections and the motion to quash. And in that, it demonstrates that the subpoena and summons were unreasonable because they were irrelevant. They were seeking items from Ms. Mullen's estranged husband and testimony from Mr. Mullen's, the estranged husband's lawyer. This case was about communication between Mr. Robinson and his client, not her estranged husband and not his attorney. The committee, as it is able to do, ruled on the motion to quash, granted it, and did not issue the summons or subpoena. That's the sum total of the record evidence before you.
Was there ever any proffer? Because in theory, the estranged wife could have said something to her estranged husband saying, yeah, here's my problem with my lawyer, blah, blah, blah. So it's not legally irrelevant. It can be legally relevant if there was some fact involved.
I would agree, Your Honor. And that could be the case. However, there was no proffer in this case. We don't know what that evidence would have been if there was evidence to begin with. And that was a failing of the appellant, not of the bar, and not of the board in its order. With regard to a violation, I'm going to move down to the next bucket that I discussed, a violation of Rule 1.4a. That rule requires that an attorney keep his client reasonably informed about the status of the case. It also requires that an attorney promptly comply with reasonable requests for information. The bar's findings are given substantial weight, and they're determined or they're assumed prima facie correct. And in this case, the bar submits that they should remain so. The appellant only cites three specific portions of the order that he takes issue with. I'd submit to the court that all this court needs to do is look at the findings of fact he takes issue with. Because if you do that, You understand that the only record evidence that this court has supports those findings of fact. For instance, in paragraph 5, Mr. Robinson didn't appear in court on behalf of Mrs. Mullins, and there was clear confusion about the two contracts that he issued and when the money that was dispersed for both would be dipped into. With regard to paragraph 6, Mrs. Mullins requested info regarding the status of her account repeatedly, at earliest in August of 2010. The appellant did offer evidence that he had sent three bills. Those were over a course of a two-year period. So you had at most three billing statements, and the client said there was one. And with regard to paragraph 7, it's clear that Mrs. Mullins was not provided an invoice on request. If you look at the record evidence before the committee, before the board, and before this court, she requested it repeatedly. At most, it was given to her on three occasions over a three-year period. And paragraph 7 also indicates that there were no timely periodic billing statements. And the bar found that three statements over a two-year period, especially in light of Ms. Mullins' repeated requests, was not sufficient. And lastly, in terms of the terms that were imposed against Mr. Robinson, those are deemed prima facie correct as well. Attorney discipline is to protect the public. It's also to deter others and maintain ethics in the legal profession. In this case, the bar found that there had been misconduct. Having done so, they do have the authority to impose a variety of sanctions. In this case, it was a public reprimand with terms. And those terms in this case required that a consultant be retained in order to review timeliness, communications, and billing practices of Mr. Robinson. Now, it should be noted that this wasn't the first time that Mr. Robinson had come upon Rule 1.4a. There had been previous bar actions, disciplinary actions, taken against him regarding that same provision, same rule. And in fact, in one of those, in the admonition, and I detail it in the brief, it was a very familiar finding of fact. There was one billing statement over a 17-month period of representation. And it wasn't itemized. And further in this case, with regard to the consultant, Mr. Robinson was represented by an attorney in these proceedings. That attorney engaged in discussions regarding the consultant. And I believe in quotes, he said it was appropriate within the rules.
Who said that?
Mr. Robinson's attorney, Mr. Rigsby.
Right, okay.
Is that in the record?
It is. And I can provide that to you, Your Honor.
Well, while you're looking for it, the bar ethics rules are there to provide a response to the lowest level of conduct that is acceptable before your peers step in and have a say about it. Above that, we have lots of aspirational standards. And it appears to me that what the bar has done here is they found conduct that was below. They addressed it and encouraged him to have practices in his office that would keep that from happening again. Is that a fair summary?
That is, Your Honor.
So I know in his brief he refers to the bar's insistence on best practices as if that is somehow what they found he didn't have. I suspect you did find that. But the discipline in this case is not for having failed to have best practices. The discipline in the case is for having practices that are below the lowest level of practices permissible at the bar before your peers step in.
I would agree, Your Honor. And those peers stepped in only after a client complained and there was probable cause found to proceed on that complaint. With regard to your question, Mr. Rigsby's comments were Appendix 163 to 164 and also 168, it appears.
Thank you. How many prior ethical obligations does Mr. Robinson have prior to this one?
Say that one
again. How many prior ethical violations existed on the record prior to this one?
We had two. There were the bar considered two previous disciplinary actions that had been taken.
One was a Rule 1.4. What was the other one?
Actually, they both contained multiple violations that did include 1.4a.
So this is the third 1.4 violation.
Correct, Your Honor. And I will find the specific. The first, they were two separate cases. It appears they were issued on the same day, February 10, 2004. An admonition with terms based on violations of Rule 1.3A, 1.4B, excuse me, it's 1.4B, Your Honor, and 1.5B. That would be at Appendix 519 to 523. And the second would be a public reprimand with terms based on violations of 1.1, 1.3, 1.4A, and 1.4B. And that is found at Appendix Site 524 to 529. And it wasn't just those previous occasions of misconduct that were taken into account. The bar did consider mitigation. Mr. Robinson testified about these two disciplinary actions. That was part of the bar proceedings, and so they considered that in addition to the disciplinary actions that had previously been taken. Based on these facts, and based on the record before this court, the bar submits again that the public reprimand with terms is justified by a reasonable view of the evidence, and it's not contrary to the law. There's no evidence that suggests otherwise. In that case, we'd respectfully request that this court affirm the board's order.
All right, your position is first that there was a failure to comply with this court's rules having to do with briefing, and that's just the source of your complaint in the motion to dismiss. And if you get beyond that, it's a failure to comply with the rules of professional ethics determined by the board.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Robinson, you have 6 minutes and 41 seconds remaining.
On the subpoena, as far as the proffer is concerned, I was represented by Mr. Rigsby, who was former bar counsel at the committee hearing. So I guess I'll deal with two things there. I don't think that he did on the record. He didn't do a formal proffer. Probably part of it was we weren't sure what the husband was going to say. I mean, there was no depositions or anything that are permitted. So, but.
Let's stop right there. So you want a subpoena for somebody you don't know what he's going to say? Why isn't that right on its face something you request? You have no idea what the subject matter is.
Well, I know from my conversations with the client that she had discussed with her husband her ongoing attorney's fees. But as to what he would specifically say, we did not know.
All right.
And then...
But why haven't you answered the Chief's first question, which is why shouldn't your appeal be either summarily denied as waived or dismissed? I mean, the brief doesn't follow the basic threshold requirements of a brief, which is show us in the appendix what you're saying so we don't have to spend 3 hours trying to figure it out, have cases and statutes and rules or at least some legal analysis to support arguments. For you to win a case and not advocate, we'd have to advocate for you, which is the reason we have these rules. But I have not heard you respond to that problem yet.
So in my reply brief, Justice Kelsey, as far as the motion to dismiss, I said that if I didn't comply with the rules, then the error was de minimis. And if there was error that was not de minimis, then I moved the court for permission to correct any errors so that the case couldn't move forward on it. It was a Not that this is necessarily a defense, but it was less than a one-page summary of facts, and the bar did not dispute the facts. I know that you have a requirement to do an independent evaluation of or independent examination of the record. So I guess in some way it's not like a normal appeal where there are some specific facts that you're going to point to. It would have been quite a long...
Well, let me go to the third bucket, as your opposing counsel mentioned, the consultant sanction. Okay, you say that as a matter of law, they don't have the authority to do that. Now, ordinarily, you would cite law to make such a statement. You'd say, here's the statute, here's the rule, here's the way it's been interpreted. But I didn't see any of that.
And I could not find it. And that's one of the things that I found interesting was that I'm supposed to find law to say that what they did was wrong. They can't prove, and they didn't have anything in their brief to say what they did was correct.
But you're the moving party. You put the ball in play. You got to have law.
Your Honor, I looked, and I could not find, I don't see where they have any authority to, I mean, other than making larger constitutional issues of due process and notice about the rule, and I don't know if you're going to impose...
If the bar has the power to recommend your dismissal from the bar entirely, why wouldn't it also subsume the lesser power of making a public reprimand with terms? And as Mr. Rigby said, evidently, that's quite often what they do. This is just one term.
Correct. And I did not... There was no assignment of error on one of the other terms, which I think was some CLEs that they wanted me to take.
How is it they don't have the power to require you to hire a consultant to deal with communication issues when this is the third violation of the ethical code on, among other things, communication issues? What's unreasonable about that?
Let me go back and, I guess, address the previous one. So about a year and a half after I started practicing, I graduated from law school, threw out my shingle, and started practicing as a solo right away. And I was doing a variety of things. One of those two cases was a family law case. One was a bankruptcy case. The office had an office suite set up with some other attorneys. They all used one particular individual to do their bankruptcies. On the bankruptcy case, I'm the attorney. It's my responsibility. That gentleman did some things wrong. He also misrepresented things on his own to the client. I'm on the hook for that. There was never any question about that. On the other one, that was about, and again, it's true, I did not send a bill until the end of the case. I never knew there was anything that said, there was nothing written, again, that said that I had to send her a bill on a monthly basis. We just don't have that in our rules. And I sent her a narrative bill. I take the Chief Justice's comments seriously about minimum standards. My assignment of error on the term is not take certain CLEs, but to hire a consultant who is going to say what. I still to this day don't know what is that minimum standard. There's a colloquy in the appendix between bar counsel, and I think my counsel had stepped out of his role as my attorney, obviously, when he was arguing, since he was previous bar counsel. The committee was turning to him for his previous experience about terms. So I would argue that he was not acting as my attorney when he made those statements. Or if he did, he may be in some trouble.
Maybe given his experience, he was hoping for a third bite at the apple for you rather than a suspension from practice, and saw that it might be the right way for him to approach this committee. And from what I can see, if this happens again, you might not get another bite at the apple. So in this argument about hiring a consultant, you know, they don't have the authority to do that. They have the authority to ask us to suspend you from practice or revoke your license.
I understand that.
And if we have that kind of authority and it comes from a recommendation from the board, I can understand why on your third trip to the disciplinary system itself, your lawyer, who had extraordinary experience as bar counsel, was saying, give me one more chance.
I guess in my remaining 10 seconds, Mr. Chief Justice, I guess I would disagree that, and I realize what the power of the board, I totally understand that, but to look at this case and say that it was anywhere close to something about disbarment or suspension, I would strongly disagree with.
Well, yeah, that's part of the problem. You're looking at this case, and they're looking at this as the third time around. You have two prior. So it's not just looking at this case. It's looking at a history that apparently has not gotten the attention it ought to get. In any event, is there something else you'd like to say? I don't want to take up your last bit of time.
Well, it's got my attention now, Mr. Chief Justice, because I send emails just, I hate to do it, but it's cover your rear end emails anytime. I have to do that now because I'm going to have to build a record. And the other thing that I do is my billing has radically changed since.
All right, Mr. Robinson, thank you for your argument.
Thank you.
The court will render its decision in due time. Call the next case.